From mountain crest to mountain crest, from canyons to the clouds and into the cosmos, we are pumping wattage high and low, streaming worldwide on the internet, and keeping you company tonight, every Saturday, the place to relax and hang out. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, and this is Speaking of Strange, giving you the latest and discussing the weirdest. We have assembled the finest team of reporters and the most intriguing guests, and that's why we are your favorite hub. Saturday nights right here. Boy, I'm excited about our guest tonight. He is a legend in the field of UFOs and the paranormal. He co-authored the classic The Day After Roswell and George Norrie's Worker in the Light. As publisher of the esteemed UFO magazine, he also leads the team on History Channel's UFO Hunters. You'll find a link to his site, UFOMag.com, on our website. And it's a great honor to say, William J. Burns, welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you for having me, Joshua. It's really great to be here.
Oh, you know, I've wanted to talk to you for so long because I'm a great admirer of your work, and you are one of these people who does it all. You are involved in every facet of the field, and I also admire the fact that you're not a person who just sits back in front of a computer. You get out there in the field doing investigations and seeing firsthand what is and is not realistic in the field. So I guess for people who may not know about you and your work, give us sort of a brief summary of how you describe what you do.
Well, really, breaking it up into UFO Hunters, which was a show that actually, the whole premise of that show came from my wife Nancy, who is the editor-in-chief of UFO Magazine, when Pat Uskert, who lived near us in California, Pat basically saw a UFO or something in the sky. Let's just say it's something in the sky in Venice. And basically he contacted the magazine, and Nancy immediately picked up on it and said, hey, this is really interesting, because one of the things Pat had done was to test out, and this is kind of how Nancy came up with the concept for the show. He tested out this kind of floating object shimmering in the sky over Venice Beach. He tested it by launching a balloon. And when Nancy saw his video of the balloon launch, she said, there is a television show, because nobody's ever done that before. Nobody's ever, and now you see it all over TV. But when we first came up with it and took it to History Channel, nobody had ever done a scientific kind of recreation to simulate an event to say, okay, if people say that's a balloon shimmering in the sky and floating away, what does a balloon look like shimmering in the sky and floating away? It's very easy to say that. He did it, and it was a great video, a great split-screen video. And then Nancy and Pat worked together to come up with how you would basically showcase this. Pat went out, did some interviews. We took it to one television network, a television production company. They came up with the idea of having three members on the team. Then from there, we took it to the production company that works for History Channel. And they said, well, let's do a test episode. Let's just see if this works. So we did a test episode for UFO Files called USO's Red Alert, which aired about 5 years ago, and it got a very high rating. So from there, they basically put together the show, and that's how UFO Hunters came to be. But the premise at its core is still there, which is if somebody makes a claim of a UFO, that's fine. We like to believe witnesses. We think that they know what they see. But let's test it out to see what else might be there that's a conventional explanation. Go after the conventional explanations first. Chinese lanterns, balloons, hoaxes, people clowning around, F-35 joint strike fighters, which look remarkably like strange hovering lights in the sky when they're standing on their tails at stall speed. I mean, there are aircraft that really come very close to doing what some of the lights in the sky do, and flying triangles, maybe it's something else, but we like to come up with all the explanations for it, test it out, So if somebody sees a flying light and it's in an air traffic control pattern somewhere, well, there's a possibility that that's a plane or that's a helicopter. And so you take photos of helicopters, take some video. So we eliminate the conventional explanations one by one and get down to a point where there's nothing more we can eliminate. At that's when we start our hypothesis. Then we try and simulate the events themselves, which we did in Indiana this year and Illinois over Tinley, the lights over Tinley Park, and ask the witnesses, is that what you saw? That's the premise of UFO Hunters.
See, that is wonderful. I could not agree more that this is an area that has been missing from the research. In fact, you would probably love a contest that we do here every year in Western North Carolina. It's called the UFO Experience, and we ask people to come from around the country and create fake UFOs that have to fly. We photograph them and videotape them and just see, as you said, what these things look like in the sky so you have some gauge or reference there when you're analyzing this stuff. So it's that important. And I guess considering now we are in a situation where people are running around with cell phones that take pictures, and you know, cameras are so cheap and accessible, and we continue to get more and more evidence and imagery, and it just goes to show that people are continuing to see things that they cannot explain. If you had an unlimited budget and unlimited access, what would you do at this point to sort of make the dream project come true, to go out and determine what needs to be done for us to really understand what this phenomenon is all about?
That's a great question, and one of the things we have talked to folks about is try to find the places where it's not just I've taken a photo of a UFO in 2003. Okay, sure, we do those episodes, and we do get the video, we do get the photos, and just from the episode we did, I believe it was 2 weeks ago, where somebody in Michigan, Bobby Dexter, saw a flying triangle over his house. It actually followed him, and there's much, much more to this story than ever got on camera. I mean, I was blown away by the depth of experience that this family had, but just based on the episode. And so he basically had the video of this triangle over kind of like across a river, small river, stream actually. And then on the road across the stream, there was a car that drove by, and it drove by basically underneath the UFO, but the driver never reported seeing a UFO. Well, that was strange, right? UFO's over your car, you don't see it. Okay, I can explain that, but nevertheless. So we thought, okay, maybe it was another car. So we actually simulated the experiment to recreate the video that he took. Well, we couldn't do it, but that's a typical way we approach things. But what I'd like to do is I would like to really go to the very edge of the envelope. There are places where folks are seeing all kinds of strange phenomena, in South America, for example. And this is an expensive proposition. You just can't take a 15-person crew and just go across South America looking for UFOs. The budget would be enormous, and you're taking professional-level cameras. You're not taking handheld cameras. The stuff we use is they're high-def, high-definition cameras that basically are used for regular feature film length motion pictures, as well as for video. And when you're shooting high def, you can't fool around. So it's got to be, we have to transport these very, very elaborate cameras and the gear and the lights, so we just can't go traipsing across a whole continent. What we want to do, what I'd love to do, is go do scouting. Scout some of the places. Scout the Nazca Line. Scout the UFO highway down there in Peru and in Chile, where supposedly there's a lot of UFO contact going on. Go to Guatemala. Go to some of the places where there are allegedly people who describe portals. Okay, let's go there. But you can't just go there and say, okay, we're here for Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. So if we don't get a UFO on camera, we're splitting. You can't do that. the UFOs, let's say, just for argument's sake, that there are UFOs that are coming out of portals. There are UFO sightings all the time. Well, they're not going to show up just because you're down there with a camera. They're not going to make an appointment with you. You've got to be there, and in some cases, you're living with indigenous people. Well, that means you're taking people who speak that language. You're going to live with them. You're going to be on the lake shore with them. If a UFO is going to come out of a lake, you want to capture it. So my dream, given an unlimited budget and an unlimited amount of time, is not just interview the witnesses, but go out, and if there are places that allegedly are contact sites for UFO, make the contact. Let's get one of these live on camera, up close and personal, and if all the stories I've heard about beings inside them, let's get them on camera. You know, I would like to get them interviewed.
Okay? Oh, yeah.
That's what I would do. I would like to come back to Los Angeles and New York with this absolute, unmistakable proof. Let the skeptics say what they want to on camera. Here is the contact. And at the end of the day, let the whole world see it. We don't need the government to admit anything. We don't need disclosure. What we need is some hard proof on camera that these things exist. That's what I'm looking for.
Hey, that sounds reasonable to me. And we have a couple minutes before our next break, but one thing I want to bring up is, of course, we at Speaking of Strange are big admirers of your magazine. In fact, my producer, Micah, writes for the magazine. And a few months ago, there was a wonderful piece that you published. I was very flattered by this, written by Timothy Green Beckley regarding some of the research that my team and I had done at Brown Mountain, where the Brown Mountain lights are seen here in western North Carolina, and actually we were able to reproduce some of these lights on a miniature scale in the laboratory, and were able to create flying saucer type shapes. Surprisingly, we weren't even trying to do that, and I wonder, how often do you think that a natural phenomenon similar to ball lightning might be creating some of these illusions, for lack of a better word, that people think is an actual physical craft?
Well, it's funny. I think that, and Brown Mountain, by the way, is one of the cases that we talk about investigating a lot, going down there and investigating. First of all, it's a historic case, and it's a historic case with a lot of residents. I mean, it's not just, I mean, a lot of people have talked about this case. Obviously, there is your book. We covered the story in the magazine, but the fact that this was also something that came to the attention of one of the pioneers of not really paranormal radio, but late night radio, late night talk show radio, Long John Nebel.
Yeah.
He was a big UFO skeptic. He did not think, and you know, we could do a whole segment just on Long John Nebel, because he didn't believe in a lot of this stuff, and yet he married Candy Jones, who was one of the subjects of MK Ultra, and basically these memories only came back to her after she was married to Long John. So it's really funny, ironically funny, that for somebody who did not believe in this but hosted a show about these kinds of phenomena, winds up being at the center of one of the great CIA conspiracies from the 1950s. Well, in any event, the Brown Mountain case, Brown Mountain Lights, really a famous case. And the fact is, can natural phenomena keep on existing? Can ball lightning be attracted year after year to a certain kind of spot? You have scientists who will not even agree on what ball lightning is.
Yeah, that's true. And actually, I tell you, Bill, let's hold it right there and take a break. And when we come back, let's dig more into Brown Mountain. And also, when we return, I'm going to ask Bill about some of his work in Roswell. His very famous book, The Day After Roswell, is a controversial tome that has startling implications, really. William J. Burns, you have seen him on UFO Hunters on the History Channel, and I'm sure you've read many of the books he's been involved with. New York Times best-selling author. Check out UFOMag.com. He publishes that. I'm Joshua P. Warren. More with Bill Burns on Speaking of Strange after this. Joshua P. Warren. You're listening to Speaking of Strange. My guest this hour is William J. Burns. He is the publisher of UFO Magazine. His wife, Nancy Burns, is the editor-in-chief. It's a fantastic publication. You've also seen him on the History Channel's UFO Hunters. And Bill, tell me more about your thoughts on the relationship between places like Brown Mountain, which seem to be natural energy spots, if you will, and UFO phenomena.
Well, that's something that we are really trying to focus on, again, this year for our next season. One of the things we want to look at is, and we tried to do something with this in portals in season one when we went to Sedona, and we actually did capture some really interesting phenomena coming out from behind the mountain. I guess it was Castle Rock. And the question is, are there places in our dimension, on our planet, where because of certain kinds of, I'll use the word vortex, or certain kinds of confluences of energy. Okay, I'm trying to be as neutral as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Strange events can occur that actually seem to defy normality. Well, supposedly one of these places is Stonehenge. And you go to Stonehenge, and you measure the electronic lines underneath the surface, ley lines, and you look at underground streams, and you try and douse for various kinds of energy coming off the stones, and you measure it in a very complex way. Now, you're not talking about nuclear energy, high energy. You're talking about, in some cases, energy so low that it's almost undetectable, right? Especially now, by the way, in the age of cell phones and satellite television and television and radio, where you've got, think of hundreds of thousands of years ago, or even just thousands of years ago, 5,000 years ago in the case of Stonehenge, where you actually don't have any other frequencies bouncing around the air, right? You just have whatever is natural to that area. Obviously, sensitives, people might be able to pick up on that energy much more easily than they are in the age of the microwave. Well, Brown Mountain might be one of those places. Sedona certainly was one of those places. There are places where, because of the confluence of energy, there may be some kind of portal, or call it a magnet, where UFOs tend to appear. And so that's the relationship. And we believe that UFOs are attracted to energy places. How many stories have you heard of UFOs hovering over high tension wires, or UFOs hovering over water for long periods of time, or even, as we found out when we were in the UK, UFOs hovering over our nuclear storage facilities? Then RAF Bentwaters. I mean, you and Tim Beckley talked a lot about RAF Bentwaters in your article in UFO Magazine. And certainly one of the, we believe, the attractions for the UFO was it's looking over whatever residual power might be leaking out from the stored nuclear weapons there. So even though the Brits won't admit that nuclear weapons were ever stored there, people who worked there, security police of the RAF, said, you know what, it was a big nuclear storage facility for weapons because it was a staging area for A-10s going to Europe. So that's one of the big relationships. It's energy. UFOs are drawn to energy. We don't know why. We don't know if they're able to suck energy out. If we're, for all we know, planet Earth, because we leak so much energy, could be like one big truck stop in UFOs.
Hey, that's a great analogy. So do you feel then that most of the, well, I won't say most, but many of the outstanding UFOs are indeed intelligently controlled devices that are sort of slipping in and out of our dimension and utilizing the natural power we get from certain spots on Earth to make it easier for them to do so?
I think that's one explanation. The short answer is yes, but I think that's partially there are other kinds of answers. I don't think that there's any one UFO. We know that because we've had reports of flying cylinders, right?
Mm-hmm.
Flying discs. I believe that flying triangles are mainly ours, but certainly flying discs, flying diamond-shaped objects, flying cylinders. So my answer is yes, but I think there are other reasons that we see them. I think that one, which Philip Corso, Lieutenant Colonel Corso, told me about, was that they're time ships. And they're time ships because I think that one of the dark secrets of UFOs are that we are locked in some kind of continuum, either at war with itself or constantly fixing itself, and that these craft are exactly what they are, transportation devices between various points on the continuum that are fixing things. And I don't know why they're fixing things. I can come up with 100 different theories, but I mean, just one is the first time somebody slips through time by accident, that's changed something, that in the entire quanta, that the entire quantum structure of the universe is changed when something or someone goes back in time or goes forward in time and does something. And does that mean this terrible thing happens, you are on this kind of Mobius strip of time travel where you always have to go back and fix, and you reach this frustrating point, this frustrating realization, there is no final fix. You're always going back, and you're always fixing.
Now, speaking of Corso, this book, The Day After Roswell, it truly is an astonishing book. I can't imagine what it must have been like for you to sit down and have this guy tell you this. And for listeners who don't know, Corso said that he was given the duty, the mission, if you will, to distribute many of the back-engineered technologies from the Roswell crash. There are people who look at this book and say, this is the proof, this is the smoking gun. Others say, hey, this was a guy from the Pentagon, this is disinformation, and they've accused him and even you of spreading disinformation to actually cover up research. How do you respond to that mindset?
Well, first of all, Corso was a real person in a real place at a real time at a real point in history. One of the things we did, obviously, I couldn't go back to 1947 and look in the Pentagon and see what was there, what came to the Pentagon. And I was only in high school in 1961 when he came to the Pentagon under Arthur Trudeau, who was the lieutenant general, the commanding officer there in Army R&D. So on the one hand, there are things that I absolutely couldn't vet, but there were things that we could vet and did vet. For example, you have to ask yourself, would a person like Philip Corso have the level of access he claimed to have, right? I mean, if he were in Sausalito, California during this period and he wasn't in the Army and he was nowhere near Army R&D or he was digging ditches someplace, you'd say, you know what? Ridiculous. But we know the guy was in Army R&D because it's in his military record. We know that he was at the Foreign Technology Desk. We know that because it says so in his military record. And suddenly, after 30 days, he disappears. Where did he go? Well, a lot of people have criticized it and said, oh, the guy was a total fraud. Come on, Bill. He was only in Army R&D for 30 days in Foreign Technology, then he disappears. Hey, come on. It's not true. Couldn't have done this in 30 days. Well, hey, guess what? He was only there 30 days because after he took over the Foreign Technology Desk, he disappeared. He went into the black world where for the next year and a half, that's where he worked as the deputy director of Army R&D. And why was he black? Well, according to Corso, he was in the black world because he was taking the Roswell debris, and it was debris. This was not, this was like the control panel of a flying saucer. It never was. It was crash debris. He took that to various defense contractors and laboratories that were already working on the technology. So this wasn't brand new technology. Where did the laser go? The laser went to the Army lab at Columbia, already working on lasers to give them a jump. Where did fiber optics go? Well, it didn't go to some chemical company. It went right to Western Electric, where they were working on some kind of filament-based transmission of power, right? Fiber optics. So it went to places where research was going on. That was one.
Okay, I got to stop you again because we have to take a break. Fascinating stuff, man. I love digging into this level of research here. Folks, I'm talking right now with William J. Burns, and he is telling us about his experience riding the day after Roswell with Colonel Philip J. Corso. I'm Joshua P. Warren. Speaking of strange, we'll be right back. Show just flies right by when you talk with a legend in the field like William J. Burns. He is with me on Speaking of Strange. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren. I could spend hours with this fella, but we only have about 20 minutes left. You've seen him on the History Channel's UFO Hunters, usually wearing a ball cap and sunglasses. I bet he can't go out in public with a ball cap and sunglasses on anymore.
actually, in California, that's what you wear. Because it's the only thing that keeps your head free from the sun. It's so intense. But I just wanted to say one thing about Corso.
Uh-huh.
That for all the vetting we did, and we found this guy did some amazing things, for all the vetting that we did, we were still, it's a big swallow, a big gulp to say UFO. That, I mean, I could spend hours on the air talking about what we've encountered with scientists who just will not budge because it's too big a paradigm to accept. So Corso's story was basically, just in a nutshell, he was tasked by his commanding officer, Arthur Trudeau, to take the Roswell crash debris and take it to defense contractors so that defense contractors could get patents for it,
mm-hmm.
reverse engineer the technology and patent it in their own name. That was the deal. And he chose me Lieutenant General Arthur Trudeau's own Army memoirs. Anybody can get these. There's nothing classified in these things. You just got to pay for Xeroxing, but it's at the Army War College in Pennsylvania, Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And I have a copy. And in it, there is this stunning, stunning description of Arthur Trudeau going to Strom Thurmond, who's obviously this legend in the Senate. He goes to Senator Strom Thurmond saying that we have all this foreign technology. This is in 1958. We have all this foreign technology that he wants developed into defense technology. And he says to Strom Thurmond, I want this for my budget. And Strom Thurmond says to him, you will not get one dime from my committee for anything that's not invented here.
Huh.
He says, you get this invented here with American patents, and you'll get all the money you need. And that was the beginning of the reverse engineering of the Roswell UFO. It's in black and white in Arthur Trudeau's own memoir. Backs up Corso. Now, did it say, oh, it's from the Roswell craft? No, because there was a lot of things in foreign technology that had nothing to do with the Roswell craft. Mounting machine guns, for example, on helicopters. course, I will explain that was a real problem for the helicopter manufacturers. They couldn't do it. It would shake the craft apart. But the Italians and the French both had machine gun mounts that would allow for that. So it was reverse engineering that technology. Anyway, that's what did it for me, seeing the Arthur Trudeau memoirs.
Corso
showed me.
Well, you obviously trusted Corso. You obviously felt he was sincere. When he started working with you to unveil these secrets, were you afraid that men in black were going to show up and shoot you? I mean, did weird things happen? How was this information allowed to be leaked or released or however you want to term it?
Well, on the one hand, Corso kind of assured me, wink, 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 that folks in the know knew what he was doing and there was no problem with it. So that's on the one hand. So when people say, oh, well, this had to be somehow approved, well, it was. But it was more approved from the point of view that the guy was 80-plus years old and nobody's going to stop him. It was the end of his life and they knew it. He'd been sick for years. So nobody was really going to stop him from doing this. That was on the one hand. It was a major publisher, right? We're both published. I know that I think one of your books, I think How to Hunt Ghosts,
yes,
was published by Fireside, which is an imprint of Simon & Schuster.
That's right.
Well, I mean, we are both the same publisher. I had a bunch of computer books back in the 80s that were published by the Fireside division of Simon & Schuster. And Day After Roswell was published by Atria in Hard and Mass Market Pocket, which are divisions of Simon & Schuster. So, I mean, you have a major publisher behind the book, and you've got the introduction or the foreword by Strom Thurmond himself, who only pulled it after his staff screamed at him to get it out, but it made it to the first three printings, saying, yeah, this is what we did, and Corso basically was the man he says he is. But Corso's background, Joshua, also was incredible. When he told the story of working for Richard Russell on the Warren Commission, and sure enough, every story he told was backed up by LBJ's own Oval Office tapes. One of the clinchers for us was, I mean, you got to trust the guy, right? Well, he was testifying before the Congressman Robert Dornan committee on MIAs. Right, big in the early 90s, big set of hearings on MIAs. And that was the reason we went to Corso in the first place. We were doing a book and a motion picture on flyers and military personnel held back by the North Vietnamese after the end, supposedly after the end of the war, the Paris peace talks. Anybody who knows that the war continued right through 1974. Nixon was actually fighting the war during his impeachment process. That was one of the big secrets. So knowing this, everybody, of course, said, well, you know, they held back our Sabre jet pilots at the end of the Korean War. The North Koreans never released them. They went to China. They went to the Soviet Union. They were brainwashed. They used their identities. Oh, people criticized Corso. He was a right-wing fanatic. He was a lunatic. He was a Nazi. I mean, you name it. They hurled the epithets at him. They said he was lying. Then they went to the National Archives to look for, to see if they could recover the presidential finding where Corso said, President Eisenhower said that he signed off on the MIAs, that he knew they were being left in North Korea. So this wasn't just, oh, we were tricked by the North Koreans. We knew what they were doing and let them do it. A terrible, terrible blemish on any presidency. And everybody said, Corso's a liar, they don't exist. Finally, they went to the Eisenhower Library in Pennsylvania. There they found the presidential finding, and on the finding, in Eisenhower's own handwriting, it said, pass to Corso.
Interesting. Okay.
Incredible, right?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's so revealing, I guess, in terms of how that operation would plan strategically to move forward. And we have to take our final break. When we come back, we only have a few minutes left, and I want to ask you about one piece of technology described in this book. I can't believe the hour is already over, but folks, I'm talking right now with Bill Burns. You've seen him on History Channel's UFO Hunters. He's the publisher of UFO Magazine, and I strongly suggest everyone go to UFOMag.com and talk about a work of high quality. We're lucky to have that type of publication still being printed in this day and age. Go to UFOMag.com. There's a link at SpeakingOfStrange.com. Final minutes with Bill Burns after this. I'm Joshua P. Warren. This is Speaking of Strange. Down to the final minutes of this hour. I'm Joshua P. Warren, and you're listening to Speaking of Strange. Bill Burns is my guest. And, you know, Bill, I have a friend named Mobius. He is also an associate producer of this program, and he has wanted to know for years about something he pointed out to me in the book. On page 49 here, there it says, quote, "There was a written description and a sketch of another device, too, like a short, stubby flashlight almost, with a self-contained power source that was nothing at all like a battery," end quote. It seemed to be some type of a laser. Did you ever learn anything more about this self-contained power source that was nothing at all like a battery? Because that could be the key to everything.
Well, the answer is no. All those records would have gone to the Army Laser Laboratory at Columbia, where they were working on devices like this ever since the middle 1950s, and we never learned anything more about it. There is another book called Dawn of a New Age, in which Corso talks about the laser and that cutting tool. And that is something that we are going to publish. If we don't publish it in hard copy, we're going to publish it as an electronic book in Filament Books, which is our electronic book company that Nancy runs, and we're going to publish it there. It has come out in Spanish. It was published in Mexico. It's called La Guerra Secreta, The Secret War. And in Italy, it's called Dawn of a New Age. It's also in Italian. We're going to make an English, going to retranslate it back into English. That talks more about the power source, but it never comes up with an explanation of the nature of the power source, only that whatever it was, I think it was kind of like myself, something like a rechargeable battery. That's from the way he described it to me personally. It seemed like it wasn't this infinite source of power. It drew its power from the ship, almost like you recharge your iPhone by plugging it into your computer's USB port. That's the way it sounded like to me.
Okay, since we just have a couple minutes left, what would you like to say to listeners so that they can help participate in gathering data and making the most of our current technology? What should they do to help us get closer to finding some answers here?
Well, the big thing is if you're carrying around a cell phone and you see something strange, don't be afraid to snap off a photo. If you see strange lights, shake off the shock and go out and get your video camera, get your still camera, get your cell phone camera. Take pictures. The more pictures we have, the more we're able to eliminate things that are conventional. But on the other hand, sometimes people in different locations in the same geographical area take photos. And the logging of the photo, the date stamp on the digital photo or digital video, allows us to triangulate the positions from where those photos were taken to establish that, okay, it's not some kind of an atmospheric phenomenon. It actually is an object. We did that in Stephenville. So the more photos, the better. And just don't be afraid to talk about your experiences. A lot of people have experiences with the paranormal, not just UFOs, but with the paranormal in general. Don't let your logical mind shut down something you've experienced because you say it could not have happened, I'm crazy, we're this, we're that. Open up your mind to it and allow yourself to do things like see the future, let your intuition run free. We spend too much time censoring our own native human abilities for our sixth sense or seventh, eighth, and ninth senses. We have the ability to see the future. We have the ability to intuit things. We have the ability to read minds. All this is natural to us. We shut it down. Don't shut yours down.
And aside from going to UFOMag.com, anywhere else you would like to tell listeners to visit who want to know more about you and your work?
You could visit us at www.history.com/UFO hunters and get the entire episode, schedule, photos, bios, things like that. Visit www.filamentbooks.com or filamentbookclub.com and take a look at our books in our electronic bookstore. We think it's a great deal. We give away a reading device for nothing if you just get the books. And take a look at the books we do at shadowlawnpress.com. So, a lot of books to read. We're in the book business.
William J. Burns, you are the best. I admire what you do. I commend you. Please keep us updated on your work, and thank you so much for being on my program tonight.
Thank you for having me, and we sure will.
All right, folks, that was Bill Burns, a true legend in the field. You're listening to Speaking of Strange.
California.